Good morning, dear SDG4 seminar audience. It's a pleasure to be in Jyväskylä and see the seminar doing so well. Thank you all for coming. In this session, we want to bring you some current topical authentic insights from teacher education in three very different contexts. We have the possibility of hearing from teacher educator colleagues working in Rwanda, China, and India about some pressing issues, exciting news, and exchange some thoughts about the value of teacher education and where teacher education might be heading towards. We had a wonderful exchange this morning over breakfast and we shared some of our career stories and we were reminded how essentially similar we are and how we ask similar questions and so on. So I hope this can be a moment of sharing, but also understanding how different the contexts can be for doing teacher education. I will very briefly introduce you our dear guests. Here to my first to my left is Professor Krishna Hares from Azimprenji University in India. He has taught a lot of different subjects as expertise across teacher education, and he's currently working with teacher education development at an institutional level. So welcome, Krishna. Professor Xinghua Wang is from Beijing Normal University. She's an expert in psychology, working with issues on child development, early childhood science education, early learning and educational psychology, especially. Warmly welcome. And then last but not least, a very fresh PhD in education, Barthélemy Bizimana. He comes from the University of Rwanda College of Education. He's a philosopher interested in philosophy of education. Welcome, Barthélemy.
Thank you.
So let's start. I would like each of you to tell what brought you to work with teacher education and what motivates you to work with teacher education. And you could also maybe present something very topical from your own institution or from the country you're working in at the moment. What is there in teacher education for you at the moment? Okay, Barthélemy, why don't you start?
Okay. Good morning. What brought me to like education is the love of young people and their growth, to see them growing intellectually and being able to become more effective in this complex world. And it's this compassion that brought me to like the work of teachers, even if the salary is not that which everyone would run after.
I think love is always a good reason, isn't it? How about Qinghua?
I'm from China and work. Oh, sorry. I'm working at Beijing Normal University, and my research area is mainly about early childhood education. So, in responding to the first question, what brought me to teacher education, I think I should provide a few words about my education. I completed my bachelor and master degree in psychology, in developmental psychology at Beijing Normal University. And my PhD work was about educational psychology at the University of Munich. After complete, Completing my PhD work, I decided to go back to China to teach at Beijing Normal University. And Beijing Normal University was established in 1902, which initiated teacher education in China's higher education. So just as the University of Jyväskylä, which pioneered teacher education in Finland. So I think it was somehow natural for me to start doing teacher education. Although Beijing Normal University has become a comprehensive and research-intensive university after a development for over a century, but I think teacher education is still a major part and the basic discipline at Beijing Normal University. So that's why I'm working in the area of early childhood education.
Thank you so much. I think University of Jyväskylä and Beijing Normal have something in common as
yeah.
home base of teacher education in the country.
Yeah.
Yes. How yeah. about Krishna?
Yeah, I wish I could say a grand story. I woke up one morning and felt like I needed to be a teacher educator. That's not my story. It was quite by accident that I became a teacher educator. You know, there's a joke we share among ourselves in India. Those who are capable of doing something, go earn some money. Those who can't do much, go teach. And those who can't do even that properly, become a teacher educator. Okay. Because you can always give advice to other people about teaching. So, I kind of believe in that a little bit. So, yeah, it just seemed an automatic transition from being a teacher for many years, working with young people. It was accidental that I became a teacher educator. And then I kind of reverse reasoned it out that I should be one and I should remain one. That's how I became a teacher educator. A lot of things that went into 17 years of working with school children of different ages that remained tacit. That remained as something that we did. This whole what is water business. you know, how to make explicit all the good practices that exist in teaching became my interest. And how to look at education in the country and the real needs of the country and what kind of teachers that does the country need became my interest. And so I remain a teacher educator. That's my story.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. And maybe you also touched upon some of the topical questions. I mean, India is a huge country and there is a debate on how teachers should be educated and what kind of teachers are needed and so on. I wonder what's the hot topic in China at the moment? What are you talking about in your coffee rooms and seminars as teacher educators?
I think one of the most concerned, I think one of the most concerned topic is professionalism of teachers. So we are also talking about how to prepare teachers, how to teach students to better prepared for a rapidly changing society and for a society for a future full of uncertainty. So we are talking about how to conceptualize professionalism and what are the key competencies a teacher should have.
Yeah, two very, very important topics that do come across in very different kinds of contexts.
Yeah.
How about Rwanda? What is hot there at
what
the moment?
What is hot in Rwanda now, they are talking about competence-based curriculum. And when we talk of competence-based curriculum, simply framed, they understand 3H. Head, heart, and hands. Head standing for the cognitive intellectual activities. Hands standing for skills and capabilities a learner is able to produce. Then heart standing for values, attitudes, emotions, and the social relational abilities. So the 3H are now being incorporated into the teaching practice. But it is very challenging because we usually in the past focused on the intellectual aspects alone. Now they are trying to see how to include the heart and the hands. And it is very difficult because if you look at the curriculum closely, it is framed from the Western philosophical background of equalitarian system or individualistic thinking. Yet the people in our situation, the society is somehow hierarchical. Everyone knows his position, even at classroom level. To ask the student who has been used to obey from home to school to society, and ask him suddenly to share knowledge in an inequalitarian way is very much challenging.
Thank you. And this leads me nicely to the next questions. Maybe this is more related to the hands and the heart part of teacher education. We have sneaked into your publications a bit, so I have individual questions for all of you. Xinghua, you work with early childhood education development, and especially on different pedagogical approaches, arts-based methods, playful learning, and so on. So I wanted to ask you, what kind of mindset would it require from teachers to introduce play-based learning in early childhood education? And what can we as teacher educators do, and what should student teachers be able to do in order to generally bring this change? That is something that we do want to introduce.
Yeah, I see. I think in traditional Chinese culture, play and learning are two like contradictory concepts. So we have a Chinese proverb which says learning is something not could not be played with or entertained. So they are really two different concepts. But in the 1980s, I think a series of national guidelines established that play should be the main activity or leading activity at least in early childhood education. So I think teachers in early childhood teachers, they have the opinion that play is a important way for preschool children to learn, and also it's a main method for early childhood teachers to implement, to carry out teaching and educational activities. But there are still challenges in practice. I think the first challenge comes from the teacher's conceptualization of play. I think in China, I think in some of the teachers' understandings, play are a kind of activity that children, they are doing some free or autonomous activities when they are playing. So, but learning, on the other hand, you have to be goal-oriented and teacher-led activities implemented in the classroom. So for some teachers, it's really a challenging task how to integrate play and learning, how to scaffold children's free play to achieve some educational goals, and how to implement teaching through play. So I think in practice, there's such a challenge. And also, I think early childhood education is very much influenced by parents. I think Chinese parents is known as the most demanding parents in the world in terms of children's education. So they want to prepare their children at a very early stage. So they send their children to many interest classes to let their children to acquire various abilities, including sports, mathematics, dancing, singing or painting or something like that. So sometimes the early childhood teachers have to make concessions to teach some skills to children, and while squeezing the play space for children. So I think that's also the challenge.
And thank you for contextualizing the whole discussion around play-based learning. It is it looks very, very different in different parts of the world. My question to Krishna is a little bit related. It is also about the so-called non-academic content in teacher education. Yes, we do need maths didactics and language didactics and so on. But then there's also other things that are part of good holistic teacher education. How do you see the role of these non-academic subjects?
Yeah, I guess all of you have read a lot about what kind of dispositions and values teachers must have, what kind of capacities they must have. Teaching is a strange kind of a know-how. I feel like there are a lot of things in teaching that have to be figured out by practice, right? And it's not just something that you can be teaching. Like a lot of words like reflection. What kind of cognitive activity is reflection? I mean, how would you teach somebody how to reflect? These questions keep haunting us all the time, right? And we keep talking about, oh, planning, reflection, teaching, and then revised replanning. We talk about all this, but what does it really mean? All the broad, possibly already, the broad, we need, teachers need soft skills. Teachers need a voice. I mean, literally, volume, loudness, clarity, pitch. We need all this. We need, a capacity to hold attention. Now, I'm going to talk about a few things that come from experience and come from the context I come in, and the so-called non-academic. Is that what you call it? Non-academic.
In
Okay.
maybe in the Finnish context, we would say arts and practical subjects,
Action
for
practice. Okay.
example. That's
Okay.
different names.
Okay. So I feel there are interesting skills and capacities that a teacher needs. I think teaching is a kind of a performance. And what do I mean by that? I don't mean it with the connotation that it's artificial and you're posturing, you're performing. I don't mean it like that, but I mean it like an extremely art and craft-based activity. It's like a performance, like a dancer or a. I know many people don't like what I'm saying, but I think it is a performance. And I would like to talk a little bit about the skills that go into such a performance and also a kind of a few things that are dispositional that are necessary. Right now, maybe I should talk about the disposition that are meta ideas, and from that we can talk about the capacities. And this is coming from my conversations with young people who want to become teachers also. Firstly, if you don't have some kind of an impersonal affection for young people, maybe you should not get into teaching. You must, and it's not a personalized affection. I'm not talking about liking some children over other children. If you don't have general compassion for humanity and a sense of affection for young people and care for them, I don't think you should come towards teaching because it requires a lot of that. Secondly, what does it mean to be attentive? Now, this is a question that again haunts me, especially with handheld screens and internet connectivities all the time. What is simple looking and listening? And how can we teach looking and listening so that learning can happen? And how can I teach this? Now, this is something that the teacher must be intrigued by, not assume that, oh, I know all the cognitive science in the matter, and I'll just go around and telling people that this is how it works. There are issues with basic attention that we struggle with today. And I feel that is something we need to be experimenting and exploring. Tenacity and persistence. I feel like if you're not tenacious, you're in trouble. So this is a disposition that I feel like extremely important. You can't give up easily. Teaching is a job in hope. If you're depressed, it's not going to work. You have to hope that people will change, society will change, and teaching is political action. That's your way of engaging with society. So I feel like if you don't believe in all this, it's going to be very complicated as a teacher, and it'll make for a very terrible classroom and also a bad teacher educator also. I mean, so some other simple things, no? What does it mean to be organized? I keep seeing that our minds are chaotic. What does it mean to go in thinking about what I want to say today? And how do I achieve that listening? to be organized and serious about what you do. I mentioned the word reflective capacity. We talk about the word a lot. I doubt it. Beyond the fifth sentence, we know how to explain it. What exactly is reflection? And now I come. These are all the meta level capacities I'm thinking about, and I'm looking at what kind of skills. For example, when you teach young people to become teachers, what are you trying to teach them? Now, and how are you trying to teach them? And I feel there are ways in which you have to be that to be able to teach that, what you might call modeling, demonstration, whatever. Now, if you can't be that, you can't talk about it endlessly. You have to allow them to be that. And for that, you have to put them in real world situations, which means they have to teach more. So to become a, it's like talking about swimming and never getting into the pool, right? You can go on endlessly talking about the physics and the buoyancy and the all that. But I mean, can you just push them into the pool a little bit? Yeah. Oh, be there. Don't walk away. Yeah. And help them through that. So I feel like these are the skills that are necessary. The disposition that are necessary and the skills that come with holding your body, holding your voice. You, I mean, in my country, people don't know how to use the blackboard. I mean, I don't know. Do you have blackboards here? Do you have whiteboards? What do you have here? Whiteboards, I suppose. Smart TVs. Okay. So we have something called the blackboard. You use chalk on it. Mm-hmm. It's a good old tool. Everybody can afford it. So how do you use this as a pedagogical tool? I mean, many people don't know that. You're speaking and you're writing the same thing on the board. I mean, even things like this. What does it mean to perform as a teacher? Mm-hmm. Right? And these are big preoccupations in my country. And these are things we're trying to look at. I'll stop here.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for bringing the meta level. I think you shared some really fundamental ideas that we can all as teacher educators relate with immediately. And I think it immediately shows the space for different kinds of pedagogies, different kinds of content in teacher education. And then my question to Barthélemy, surprise, surprise, is about philosophy. You have done research on African philosophies in education. How can the African philosophies contribute to renewal of teacher education?
Mm.
And I'll give you exactly 3 minutes.
Okay, I will try to answer in that range of minutes. African philosophies, we have a very big range of African philosophies, and most of them are a direct reaction to the Eurocentrism in terms of epistemological production. And in that sense, I don't share the idea that this can help in improving education, but rather I prefer the other side of this African philosophy of opening up to the world and sharing experiences with others. And this is what I profoundly believe. Instead of becoming an island and trying to justify your own philosophies, because these things are relative most of the time and particular to people, situations, space, and time. And I would really like to answer to the question of my colleague here. How can you teach people to reflect? By continuing my intervention, you see, you can question your own culture, question your own values, question your own knowledge, doubting yourself. This is the beginning of the compassion towards others. You are not the only one, you see. And others think like you maybe, but in a different way. So if you question yourself, if you question your own beliefs, your own knowledge, this is a foundation for interculturalism.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. So much for that. So it is about both us as individuals and the questions we ask, but it's also about recognizing different ways of knowing different epistemologies and somehow being brave enough to engage with all that. And I think we definitely need this in order to resist some of the global pressures that are put on us by the SDG monitoring or whatever marketization of higher education and all these things. I think philosophy is definitely something we should keep as part of teacher education also in order to resist and deal with what is being imposed on us, if I dare to say. Thank you so much. Actually, I did. My next question is about the international trends. I probably mentioned a couple. How do these international trends and pressures influence teacher education in your context? Who would like to start? Tsinghua, yeah.
Yeah. I think those who are most sensitive to international trends are not teachers in basic education, but academics in universities.
Yes.
I think at universities are increasingly emphasizing international publication and the evaluation orientation, like the QS ranking and the like. So university academics should be kept abreast with the international trend. So some international concepts or frameworks like education for sustainable development, STEM education, somebody referred to this morning, and also the cultivation of global citizenship was firstly reflected in teacher education curriculum and teaching. Oh, sorry. And teaching practices in universities affecting student teachers and then gradually into the teaching practice of basic education.
Thank you for pointing to the critical role of academic teacher educators. I think we have a huge responsibility
Yeah, so I think.
here. And we spoke about criticality yesterday. What does it mean to be critical? I think this is.
Yeah, I think the teacher educators should be critically reflect upon the concepts or frameworks from a different cultural background and to integrate these terminologies into your own cultural context. But it doesn't mean that teacher educators should keep the international influence outside the classroom. I think they should introduce these global educational issues into their teaching practice to spark ideas, to initiate discussions and reflections,
Yeah, absolutely. Finding the balance between the two. Krishna, would you like to continue?
That's I don't know where to start with the question. See, India is a country of very mixed realities, and we are still struggling with basic literacy and numeracy, and we have a world that aspires to keep abreast with international research, teacher education research, and so these are ends of the spectrum for us. I feel there is an intellectualization which can be an escape through seeking answers from the world outside, because you know, the better technology, better facilities, better insights, better systems. But a lot of knowledge that has to be generated about change, social change, and education has to be from within. And I suppose that's something we need to keep working hard at. We're quite far from it. And I'm talking about nothing that I say will be one monochrome description of a place like India, unfortunately. So whatever I say, you can always be sure there's an exception to what I'm saying. So in some sense, like I come from a university where people are quite well educated and come from quite privileged backgrounds also, and who have access to international work. And that does influence our thinking and talking. Sometimes it trickles down in bad ways
to policy and also to the classroom. Many people will talk about learning centeredness, yeah, and it gets very confused. Not learning centeredness, learner centeredness, and I feel like somewhere it has become very indulging of young people. I don't know how many people are going to catch me or try and kill me, but I feel there is. We should change the language around this. For example, it is. What if the topography is not, that there is no center? What if there is the landscape of learning, and the learner, the teacher, the society, the parents, their aspirations, they're all part of this game, right? Why is it that it has to be teacher-centered or learner-centered? I mean, why does it have to be, you know, one thing or the other? That topographical description itself doesn't suit me anymore, given the nature of my country, right? So questions like this keep coming up. You were talking about, I was talking with you this morning, teacher autonomy is a big deal, right? Yeah. It is a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition. Yeah, there'll be chaos in parts of India if you give teacher autonomy, because they don't know what to do with it. Autonomy comes from informed decision making, right? You make choices based on certain kinds of information. Many teachers are not professional teachers; they're just executive technicians in the country, and we need it given the context of the country. So these are the questions that come to me when I look at international research, when I look at that influencing our thinking. I think there has to be a capacity to talk to what is in our own context, and from there, that's as much as I can say.
Absolutely, thank you, thank you so much, Barthelemy. What do you want to add?
Okay,
on international influences.
Yes, I want to add that Rwanda is making an effort to integrate. Some international influences, such as, for example, the 21st century skills into the ways teaching is taking place. Huh? 21st century skills, some of them we have like critical thinking, technology, collaboration, and so on. And it is very difficult to arrive and achieve these skills, because those who might have suggested these skills have a different context. And we don't have enough resources to be able to achieve these skills. And this is a very big challenge. Yes.
Thank you. And you might also want to ask whether these skills are relevant. Mm. In yes. all contexts.
I exactly. Think,
this is the resistance I was referring to. Why should we accept everything that comes from somewhere? This panel is one of the activities of the Global Innovation Network for Teaching and Learning, known as the GINTL, that has been popping up throughout the seminar. And our purpose and reason to exist as a network is to advance international partnerships between higher education institutions in the three global regions. And our small country of Finland, our government has considered it is important for Finnish universities to engage globally with universities in the area of education. So my question to you is how do you see international partnerships, and how can they support your work as teacher educators and as teacher education institutions? What is there that these kinds of partnerships and traveling back and forth can give to us? Maybe it's Barthelemy's turn to start.
Okay. I think the collaboration already is a good start. And if it can be strengthened in terms of practicality, and maybe if powerful countries can help our countries and build institutions that can channel education in order to facilitate, for example, students from our parts to come and study and go back to our countries that kind of partnership can be fruitful.
So you would like to have a larger scale for activities like this.
Yes, but also funding students to study because we don't have many PhD students, many master students, and if they can get scholarships to improve their abilities, this can boost our countries.
I think mobility is maybe the best known context for international higher education. And we have a lot of examples, especially from China and India, and what happens in that area. How about the Xinhua? How do you think these kind of partnerships can support your work?
Yeah, I think many problems in early childhood education are global problems, such as the shortage of quality workforce and the low income of care service educators or early care service educators. So I think there are valuable experiences from other countries that China can learn from. For example, as far as I know, in Finland, a master degree is required to be a basic educator. And in China, in recent years, an increasing number of master students are going to be teachers in kindergartens, in primary and secondary schools. So I think this is something we learn from international experiences. And also, as a second point, I would like to provide an example of our institute. We built some collaborations with international preschools, for example, in Norway, in Canada, in Germany. And we want to enhance the student teachers' mobility, so they have the opportunities to do some internships in other countries. So one of our master students, after her internship in Norway, she decided to take the topic of the teacher's conceptualization of safety as her master thesis, as the topic of her master thesis, because during her internship, she realized that teachers in these two countries, they had very different conceptualization of safety, of what are safe, what are unsafe. The Norwegian teachers, they see Chinese parents riding bicycle with their children sitting on the back seat without a helmet. They see that as very dangerous and unsafe. But for Chinese teachers, they see the Norwegian kindergarten, the children in Norwegian kindergartens, they are doing some risky play like climbing or zip lining in forest. And this is unbelievable for Chinese teachers. So it's really an interesting topic. So I think this is what we learned from international mobility.
I think that's a wonderfully concrete example to look into a certain topic in very different contexts.
Yeah.
Opens up your understanding to it. Krishna.
Yeah, I, of course, I'm agreeing with whatever both of them have said. But I feel like all good friendship, come home. I mean, come see us, and we'll come and see you. And you will see the various conditions in which education happens in India. As I think that's the first thing. We don't even know each other's lives. And funnily, we are very similar, and funnily, we are very different. And I think for any kind of learning from each other, like they do in my part of the world, come home, eat my food, and visit my school, and see what happens. And I feel there's a lot we take from the international community. We take a lot from the Finnish education system. But I feel it's misplaced until and unless we understand the context. They look like fancy ideas that we need to kind of replicate, and they'd make no sense in certain contexts. And therefore, we need intelligent re-evaluation of those ideas in the contexts that we come from. Yeah, I think we need more people going to different places in the country, in the world, to see how education happens there. And I think you're doing that in many ways. More of it would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to add something small,
yes,
if
please.
possible.
Yes, of
Yeah,
course.
I liked very much the Finnish system where education is free for all. I think this can save humanity. If education was free for all everywhere, I think we would have less wars. Because most of the causes of the wars are ignorance. And not only cognitive ignorance, but moral ignorance. And this can be achieved by free universal education. If these kinds of gatherings can continue to bring together people from different places, this can be materialized in other parts of the world where this is not the case. Because when education is not a priority, people are in competition, they can kill each other, they can harm each other. But when education is free, they are all empowered to live together. Because living together is a good idea, but if you are not empowered to live together, but for example, if I'm hungry and you ask me to live together with you are eating every day. How am I going to be peaceful with you? So this is just an example. Another example is teacher autonomy. It comes as a result of free education also. If you have been educated and they trust in you, this really can make classes enjoyable. Instead of forcing all classes to follow the same program, it looks like the other image I saw yesterday from the presentation of a student, a master student, that if you force a fish to climb a tree, it will think all its life that it is stupid. So that is it.
Thank you. I think you let us to the next question. Now this is your time and your opportunity to visit Finland, and there will be opportunities for people from here to visit your respective institutions. Apart from the free education and teacher autonomy that Barthelemy also mentioned, is there something that you have been fascinated by in the Finnish education and especially teacher education that you think could be somehow worth mm-hmm. thinking and considering in your own context?
I think I have answered to that question.
Have answered. So let me pass on to Xinghua.
Yeah, I think some has also been talked in my previous responding to your questions. Yeah. But here I'd like to share an example. I recently have been working on a project in collaboration with colleagues from the University of Turku, Helsinki, and University of Oulu. So this study was mainly about a student teacher's internship experiences. We aim to explore how to provide quality guidance or mentorship to students during their internship. So I really learned a lot from the Finnish model of co-mentoring. Mm-hmm. So in this co-mentoring model, the student teacher, together with a tutor from the university and a mentor from the kindergartens, so they have dialogues together to reflect upon some critical incidents during the student teacher encounter during her internship. So I think this is really a nice model to learn from, and I also tried to implement this group mentoring model in my country when I was supervising my student teachers to do internship in kindergartens. Yeah.
Thank you for another very concrete example. And I think this reminds us how important it is to go beyond visiting back and forth. We can yes, get excited about things, we might be exposed to something briefly, but then in order to actually put something to work requires longer collaboration and critical reflections, maybe joint research and so on before we can actually apply something new in our context.
Yeah.
But maybe this kind of even brief visits can be a good start that stimulate our thinking and make us aware of opportunities. Yeah, Krishna.
Yesterday, was it yesterday? Must be day before yesterday. Actually, I can't tell. The days and nights are smudging. You were talking about professional practice. Pasi was talking about how visiting schools every year in your program, in the teacher education program, you're kind of reframing your curriculum to make that possible. So that's been on our minds that teacher education is not about learning a lot of perspectives and theories and then going and practicing it and then finding that it's not working and then getting disillusioned and then starting all over again. I think there has to be a give and take between practice and thinking about practice. It just struck me as we were talking that when we talk about different contexts of practice, so it's good to definitely spend time actually teaching for Finnish teacher education students in the schools. You have your lab schools, I think, right? Yeah. So it's good to do that. But what would it feel like for them to actually teach in a completely different context for a month? Come to India, teach in a government school and see what happens. And similarly for our students, they can actually come here and spend a month in teaching in a school here and see how that works. That was something that crossed my mind. I'm also curious about many things, though I've kind of sufficiently harped about context and all that. I'm quite curious how you achieve some of these things here. I went to the Yellow Library. Abhi, is that what it's called? Yellow Library.
The main
The
library.
the bustling one. So I don't know how you achieve that. That students at 7 o'clock in the cold evening are sitting there and actually studying. I mean, what's wrong with you? I mean, I would like to see that. I would like to see that level of autonomy and excitement about learning. And I'd like to talk about how you inspire your people to become teachers. I know teaching is a much more lucrative job here, at least more respectable. In India, it's not. So we need to figure out how to do that first. So these are the questions I have. And I would like to take these away with me. Isn't that the question?
Yes,
Yeah,
and I think
okay.
these are
After my answer, I'm asking you what the question is.
these are wonderful questions after a very short, a few days in this context, a few observations on what is happening around at the university. So maybe this comes to the point of getting inspired and being able to ask new kinds of questions. Absolutely. But at the core, we essentially do the same work with similar values to a large extent and so on. But it's more about understanding what's behind the practices and what makes something work and what might work somewhere else, but and why it may not do so. Before I open the floor for the audience, you can already start thinking about questions to the panelists. I want to ask one final question. This is a traditional one. How do you see the future of teacher education in your context? You can talk about different scenarios or simply how do you see the prospects for the future?
Okay. For the future, I think all students should be trained in philosophy. Because with
Agree.
philosophy, you will be brought to become autonomous, independent thinker. And if you are an autonomous, independent thinker, you will not need a teacher to teach you how to adapt, but you will do it by yourself by becoming your own teacher. Yes.
Wonderful. Xinghua.
I think the declining birth rate has important implications for early childhood education. And in China, we have a so-called dual system for early childhood education. So we have infants and toddlers under 3 years. They will be in child care services under the responsibility of the national health sector. But for children aged 3 to 6 years old, they will be into kindergartens or preschools under the responsibility of the Ministry of Education. So because of the low birth rate now, many kindergarten teachers are facing the problem to change their jobs. And the greatest possibility is they will be child care educators for infants and toddlers. So I think how to train these teachers, these kindergarten teachers, to be child care educators is a big challenge in some time to come.
Absolutely, and considering the scale of things in China, this is a massive, massive reform that is ahead of you. How about Krishna?
Yeah, the hope for the future is that more and more people become teachers in the first place in India and take it seriously so that they get qualified to teach. This is our first challenge. The hope is that many people will want to go out and teach the people who need the education, not just where the market is, as a land of diversity and inequality. A lot goes away from the people who really need it. So even the people who come from that background end up going elsewhere. And there are very few who go back to teach in their own villages and in their own government schools. And that's the need of the hour. That's, I hope, the future of India, because we have a massive school-going population with single teachers, no second classrooms and whatnot. And I think that's the need of the hour. And I hope the future will be shining in that direction rather than anything else.
I would like to add something, if I may.
Please.
Yes, using the example of WhatsApp, for example, if you are not connected, what happens? You continue seeing your former messages. But when you get connected, you see new messages. I use this image to say that we should familiarize our students, our schools, our classes to remain connected to other systems, like the way we came here, and maybe you came there and you will come again. And if we remain connected as a web of educators, I think we shall be up to date and nothing will escape from us. Yes, this collaboration through dialogue, through compassion and empathy towards each others. It's not just a question of sharing knowledge, but a question of sharing our deep humanity.
Absolutely, and that's so fundamental at all levels. It starts from talking to your colleagues more and then engaging with colleagues from across the world, enabling your students to learn about different realities and so on. So I think it's a wonderful note to finish with. And this maybe gives us some hope that we need for the work. Thank you so much for the panelists. I was allowed us to go a few minutes over time because we could start 15 minutes after, and I really want the audience to have a chance to reflect a little bit. Hey, some burning critical questions to the panelists. Did we have one online already? Can somebody read it, or should I read it from here? Yes, let's take the first question online to respect people who are hanging in there behind their screens. Question for panelists. What is the gender divide in teachers or teacher students in your country? And are there negative or positive attitudes towards one gender? And there's additional information. In the Finnish context, a majority of teachers are women, and it's a constant discussion on how there should be more men in teaching. So, who would like to share some gender related information?
Okay, I will start. In my country, there has been a lot of efforts to develop gender equality, equity, gender sensitivity, gender mainstreaming into programs of the institutions across the country. However, the country, culturally speaking, is still patriotic, patriarchal, patriarchal. I don't know whether I have pronounced the word very well. Patriarchy is the dominance of men, the dominance of women by men. And this is seen across the country, but the rules and laws are different. For example, in our parliament, we have more women than men, and it is among the first parliament with more women. And at school, though, there is a difference. In primary school, we have many women than men. In secondary, they reduce almost equal. In university, we have more men. So you see, the more you climb up, except in parliament and some government positions, the less women you have. So I think it is still due to the stereotypes, gender stereotypes related to the history based on patriarchy. And I think we need more feminists.
Thank you for sharing the Rwandan experience.
To add something, I think the majority of teachers are women. This is also true in China, especially in early childhood education, because women are considered to be more caring in nature. So some parents would like to have their children working with women teachers. But there's also the debate, and some researchers or practitioners, they think it's important for children to have some male teachers, to especially for boys, to take some male teachers as role models to learn how to behave appropriately. I mean, in this what was the word?
The system.
Yeah, in the society, to be acceptable to behave appropriately. So I think some kindergartens, they are doing some extra class activities, having some male teachers, for example, to have some basketball classes with male teachers. But these teachers are not full-time teachers in kindergartens, but they are from some training institutions. So this is a solution.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but it's at least it's acknowledged, and there are some efforts to
Yeah.
bring in a little more
Yeah.
diversity in gender.
Yeah.
Krishna, what's your view?
Yeah, my answer, one word answer to the question is ditto. It's the same in India. I mean, in a lighthearted way, I'm happy that there are more women somewhere in which matters, socially and politically, because at least that is a space that women can occupy in some sense. Unfortunately, it's a relegation. It's not a in mo for example, most school teaching in India is considered as something that anybody can do and some what you can do without much training. And rather than sitting at home as a I don't know if this phrase exists here. Housewife. Do you know this phrase? It's a very Indian term. Why don't you go and teach some children and make some money? I mean, that attitude still continues. I can't say, actually, Rwanda, the women being in the parliament is a good thing. I can't say that about India. We have all kinds of need for representation, but we haven't achieved it. It is a bleak scene. And like he said, we need more women to kick the butts of men. This is too much not being allowed constantly. And there is institutionalized sexism that prevails constantly, that disallows equality in that form. Well, I'm just describing the whole thing again. I don't have a solution in the sense, other than that, I think education is the only solution. I mean, teach boys and girls to treat each other equally all the way from the beginning. That's one way to start.
Can I add something?
So you have a solution.
Yeah.
Quickly, quickly, so we can allow a few more questions.
Yes, I forgot one component in gender issues there. For example, the LGBT plus. In my country, it is not very much yet recognized and known by many people. So if you come there, you may be sensitive about that. Yes, it is a gender discrimination, of course,
Yes.
but it is not yet spread among the people, even the intellectuals.
Okay, I think I saw a hand here in the audience. Let's have one more question, or let's say two more.
Hello, my question is for Barthélemy. And so you mentioned humanization in education. And in that context, when I was preparing for another course, I came across an article that mentions Rwanda. And it says how basically, like, the main idea of the article was education for forgiveness, especially considering your country's history. And I would like to know more about it, I guess.
Okay, thank you for the question. Rwanda, in 1994, there was a genocide against a group of people called the Tutsis between this. And this genocide was a real break, a real divide among people. It created division, it created chaos. But in the 28 years after genocide, there were a lot of efforts to reunite people. So they used the different homegrown solutions. For example, the gachacha, it is a transitional justice where they could bring people together in a village and they try to see where there is a problem. And that is how they solved many cases of genocide that legal systems could not solve in a few time. But then there were programs, especially by churches, to call people for forgiveness, to forgive others. And many people, especially the victims, responded to this and forgave the people who killed their relatives. And this was a very big catalyzer for unity and reconciliation. That is how Rwanda passed through reconciliation, unity, and resilience. Now we are in the resilience period. I don't think everyone has forgiven, but it seems majority have done so. Rwanda now is a peaceful country. If you come there, you cannot even notice that there has been a genocide there. But people are so open to love each other, to understand each other, to be compassionate towards each other, to be empathetic. And that is how we live together today. We are no longer thinking in terms of groups and categories. We have a program which is called the Ndi Umunyarwanda, We have one identity of being Umunyarwanda rather than having previous identities before the genocide, namely Hutu Tutsis, which in some way led people to fight each other. So now it is Ndumunyarwanda. We feel belonging to one identity rather than to many opposing identities.
Thank you for sharing the Rwandan story. It's really worth reading and learning more about it. It's truly remarkable for educators, especially. One very brief final question from upstairs.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Bartholomew. Hope I pronounce your name correctly. When you talk about, there's a suggestion that students need to learn more philosophy and its help for the autonomous thinking. My question is that since in philosophy, there's a lot of branches and also there are a lot of different philosophies based on different land and based on different context, and philosophy had been developed differently, and different types of philosophies would shape people to think differently. So when you're talking about this, what type of philosophy are you referring to?
Good question. I'm not referring to the Western philosophy alone. I'm referring to the way people all over the world use their rationality to understand the world, to understand reality around them. So you can use, if you want, the Western philosophy. You talked about the branches of philosophy, the metaphysics, the epistemology, the logic, the ethics, the aesthetics. You can use that, or you can use the Chinese philosophy, the yin and yang, or the Indian philosophy, or other philosophies that you may know. The essential thing here is to develop your autonomous capacity to think critically, rationally, or in a personal way, in a way that can really help humanity to be humanity, to advance humanity. Your own humanity first, then the humanity of others.
I cannot think of a better final note for this panel. Thank you so much for coming all the way to Jyväskylä to be with us today to share your ideas. Thank you to the audience for amazing attention and listening.